And welcome to the LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Matt Dumont, an LSAT teacher and tutor at the LSAT Demon and a 2L at the University of Maryland. With me is Pushkar Chobel, an LSAT teacher and an LSAT teacher at the LSAT Demon and a corporate strategy manager for a Fortune 100 retailer. How are you doing, Pushkar?
Doing well, Matt. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. I want to ask, like, how is your experience with being a corporate strategy manager for a Fortune 100 retailer? That sounds super interesting and super cool. What do you do? How do you like it?
Yeah. Well, thanks. First off, thanks for having me here. Really great to be on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Listener. I actually started right out of college doing management consulting for a big management consulting firm. Mostly doing healthcare and retail strategy.
Okay.
And about a month ago, I switched over in-house to a big retailer that I'm sure we'll all know. But it's been really good, basically helping define problems, looking at outside trends, and how to help our organization stay ahead of trends, stay ahead of competitors, that kind of thing.
Cool. So what did you go for your undergrad for?
I went to the University of Minnesota, and I studied finance and information systems.
Okay. It sounds like that tracks. And now you're, of course, you studied for the LSAT, you're on the LSAT Demon team. What do you want to do with a law degree? Like, what are your intentions on going to law school?
Yeah. So from the management consulting experience, I kind of learned that professional services at a big firm was kind of the place for me, was an environment that I felt really comfortable in. So from a law perspective, after going to law school, would love to go into corporate law, big law, as it's called, I guess, and do, you know, mergers and acquisitions work or antitrust, that kind of thing.
Awesome. Well, that is a perfect segue for the email that we have today. We didn't set that up on purpose or anything. So we have an email here from Jimmy, and Jimmy says, "Hey guys, what is considered big law?" Seems like a great question for you. He continues on to, does it have to be a firm that employs over 100 attorneys? ? What is the usual route post big law? And then does big law always pay a high rate? Thanks, Jimmy. So I really want to kind of like turn it over to you. I am not the one inclined to go into big law. I certainly know some about it. I've interviewed for some of it. So I'll talk a little bit about that. But what is big law? What is considered big law?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, these are really good questions. And these are questions I personally had about, you know, a year or 2 years ago before I started doing some informational interviews with big law associates and folks in law school trying to apply for big law jobs. So I've done some research around it, have had some conversations. And from what I can tell, there's not exactly a hard and fast definition of big law, but, you know, from what the characteristics are, you know, the bigger ones have more than 1,000 partners. But in general, I think over 100 lawyers is typical for big law. Typically, you'll have multiple branches all around the country or even internationally. Some have global reach. And, you know, their clients are often big corporations, right? Your Fortune 500s, your Fortune 1000.
Right.
And the work is very much corporate focused.
Yeah.
Your M&A.
These are the firms that are working for Pepsi, for Sony, for...
Precisely. Exxon.
Kraft, Nabisco, like those kind of companies, because they have money coming out of their ears. They're fighting with other companies that have money coming out of their ears. And so they need 1,000 lawyers to represent them in some complicated trademark dispute, for instance.
Exactly. These guys have deep pockets. They can afford to get, you know, 100 or some lawyers at really, really high rates to do their bidding for them.
Right.
So there's a big market for it. There's always a bunch of, you know, associate positions available that students try to compete for.
Yeah. And one of the places that you can find out a little bit more about big law type stuff is looking into like Am Law, like the Am Law Top 100, for instance, or the Am Law Top 50, the Am Law Top 10. There's all these sort of different characteristics, and a lot of the big laws are represented, your Skadden Arps or whatever it is, your McGuire Woods, your Venable. Like those kind of big firms. And I listed some ones that are local to Maryland because I've interviewed for them and gone through that OCI process. Those kind of big firms, you can find information about those kind of big firms by looking at, for instance, the Am Law Top whatever's lists. Okay, so I think we answered like what is considered big law. It's literally big law. It's law firms that have a bunch of lawyers, a bunch of partners, not your local mom and pop shop that has, you know, five partners and, you know, 20 associates. We're talking about a bit bigger than that, handling more complex litigation, often doing more regional offices and like corporate headquarters somewhere, doing that kind of work. Then, what's the usual route post big law? And my thing that I would laugh about is like, if this is meant to ask what do people do after big law, a lot of people wash out is my response. Like a fair amount of big law lawyers get burnt out because you're working 80, 100 hours a week, like as an associate. Yes, you're getting paid a crap ton of money for your law degree, but a lot of big law lawyers wash out. That being said, it's a lot of up or out. And so you either move up the chain to, you know, a senior associate, partner level type stuff, or you're flushed out of the company as it is. And so people tend to go one of those three routes. They leave law altogether. and there's plenty of blog information out there for that. They progress up the corporate ladder like they would anywhere else, or they transition to another area of law, becoming a teacher, for instance, or going to a smaller firm, hanging their own shingle, changing completely dramatically, going in-house somewhere as an in-house counsel. So I know that that's kind of like one of your things. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. From the conversations I've had with folks in big law, I think a lot of them do want to, you know, try something else in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years. So I think there is a lot of trying something else down the line is the path for many people. From a consulting standpoint, I kind of had a high burn consulting job for 3 years, and eventually I ended up going in house at a retailer. So I think those kind of parallels in big law happen all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And in-house counsel used to be something of like a unicorn job of like, oh, there's one in-house general counsel at this firm, and that person practiced in big law and was like a partner for like 10 years. There's actually a lot of people making their transition to in-house much sooner. And a lot of the bigger corporations have more robust in-house legal teams to handle the day-to-day stuff that they're dealing with. And so that's more of a reality for more younger lawyers. I'm not saying like fresh out of college. Typically, you still need some experience, doing that big law world. But, you know, it isn't unheard of anymore for an associate with a couple of years under their belt to then transition to being an in-house counsel for a corporation of the smaller variety, if not the larger.
Exactly.
Yeah. So last question that Jimmy had was, does big law always pay a high rate? And that's where the money is, right?
I think that's the appeal for many students coming out of law school. As you said, law school is very expensive, especially if if you don't take the time to prep for the LSAT, you might not get those scholarships, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I think those big law salaries are very enticing for a lot of kids. That being said, the initial rates I've seen are like around $205,000 for starting.
Well, that's even higher than the ones I've been seeing. I think the standard, except like the top is like 190. I think now it might be pushing 200, but 205. Yeah. Wow, that's okay.
That's what I take it. For the highest brackets nowadays, in this kind of inflationary market that we're in. And I know that they were doing actually additional bonuses during COVID too, because so many folks are getting burnt out. So. Yeah. The money is there.
Yeah.
That being said, I know there are a few like big law firms that are headquartered in the Midwest, take Kansas City, for example, that come in at a little lower rate, but they also don't require as many billable hours from their associates.
Right.
I think for the top tier big law firms, they clock in at least 2,000 billable hours a year.
And 2,000 billable hours means like 2,500 or 2,800 actual hours, which is a lot.
Right. Once you combine in client work, firm development stuff, recruiting, et cetera, that all adds up. That definitely eats into your social time, your casual work time outside of work that you normally have.
Yeah. What time outside of work?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so just to compare, like you were just talking about, so some of the big law firms that I did OCI with at Maryland, I went through the summer OCI process with a couple of big firms. And like their starting salary was in the 190 range because they have a regional headquarter, for instance, in Baltimore, where the New York office pays more, like you were talking about. Now, a more mid-level firm, just to compare it, that's not big law, but is still doing that same kind of work at a lower level, again, in Baltimore, might be at like 130. And so there is a sizable decrease, but also a sizable decrease in the expectations, like 800 billable hours instead of 2000 or 2100, et cetera. So there is that comparison. So you can get high rates outside of big law. It's just not as common. The people who are making half $1 million a year are big law associates and senior associates and partners, et cetera. To that end, one of my favorite little tidbits, I saw this in the New York Times, I think like a year ago or so, headhunters for big law firms are paying $500,000 signing bonuses.
Oh my gosh.
If you've been a clerk on the Supreme Court. So if you really want to make that money, go be a clerk on the Supreme Court and make $500,000 just to sign on the dotted line.
That's right. Easy as pie.
Easy as pie, right? Okay, so do you have anything to sort of add to this big law, what it entails, any of that kind of stuff? How do you get to big law? Because I feel like that might be a good question to also answer.
And I've asked this question to a lot of folks who are in big law now, and they say that the number one thing you need to get right in law school is your grades. GPA is one of the biggest determinants for getting that OCI on-campus interview in the first place.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think a close thing after that might be journal or some extracurriculars, but really GPA is the most important determinant.
Yeah, so I want to hard echo that. Journal and like moot court or mock trial, like those kind of extracurriculars that add like a check mark next to your name are often required in some form, but the big law firms that did OCI at my school, I'm going to University of Maryland. We're not exactly a big law magnet, like, for instance, Yale, Stanford, Harvard are going to be. They wouldn't even accept your resume unless you're in the top 5% of the class at my school. Now, but even at like Yale, Harvard, Stanford, like they're going to want the best and brightest. And so even there, they're going to be looking at the top half of the class rather than the bottom half of the class. And those other classes that are, or those other schools that are outside of HYS are going to be looking at the upper tier of class at University of Virginia, University of Michigan, Berkeley, et cetera.
Right.
They still want the best and brightest at that school. So your grades, number one.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's funny too, because from what I've heard, the work you do in law school isn't necessarily the same that you do in big law. That being said, I think GPA is a really good proxy for law firms to understand how hardworking you are.
What they want to see. They can teach you how to do the right mergers and moves and all that kind of stuff. They want to know that you are a hard worker, you busted your ass to get a 4.0 at UVA, and you're a killer for doing it. They want that person. Awesome. Anything last to add?
No, nothing from my end. What I would say is try to have conversations with actual big law associates to see if that lifestyle is right for you.
Yes, absolutely. Nathan always kind of advocates this kind of stuff of like, reach out on LinkedIn to someone who's doing the job that you want and ask them if you can talk to them about it. So if you really want to go into big law, Jimmy, check out LinkedIn, try to network with some people to find out what big law lawyers actually do, and make sure that you want to do that too before you sign on the dotted line to go for law school. So anything else?
Yeah. I mean, just going off that, I know it's sometimes scary to cold, you know, reach out to people on LinkedIn, but one trick I used is I looked at people who went to my undergraduate institution and who were practicing big law. And like, that was kind of my starting point, was hey, we went to the same, you know, place for college. We probably had the same professors. How was your experience in law school at Big Law? That kind of thing.
Perfect. With that, I want to say, Jimmy, thank you so much for writing in. Pushkar, thank you so much for being a guest on today. And yeah. Nathan, thank you for letting me host for this one. So Pushkar is a new teacher at the LSAT Demon. Come check out his classes if you're a subscriber. I'm also a teacher at the LSAT Demon. Pushkar, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Awesome. If you'd like to be on the show, send us an email to help@lsatdemon.com. We'd love to hear your LSAT or law school admissions questions. Thank you so much for listening, and don't pay for law school.